AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 243 for May 23rd. The secret illegal race that nobody knows about. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
What really set the U.S. Express apart from the Cannonball was that U.S. Express was really interested in one thing, finding the best drivers who were going to make the best effort to get the best speed and do it in a way that was safe and efficient.
These people were dead serious. This was pure competitive mentality. We've got to be first. We've got to be the fastest there's ever been, and we will do whatever it takes.
Okay, what you've just been seeing and listening to is a clip from a documentary that's coming out called 32 Hours, 7 Minutes. And as you heard the reference to, it was the start of the Cannonball Baker Sea to Shining Sea race that then became the U.S. Express. Somebody set a record of going across the country in 32 hours and 7 minutes. This became a great controversy as to whether it was realistic or did they cheat. And so Corey Wells is a producer or director or both, I guess.
Filmmaker.
Who's got together with some other people to see if they could match or beat that record. And we're going to have her later on in the show.
In fact, there she is.
Corey up on the screen right now. So, Corey, thanks for joining us. Just say hello so people know you can talk. And then we'll see you later on in about another 20 or 30 minutes. We'll be talking more with you. And then we'll be bringing in Elliot Wilhelm. The director at the Detroit Institute, or Detroit Film Theater. Do I have that right, Todd?
Yeah, the Detroit Film Theater of the Detroit Institute of Arts.
Part
of the DIA.
Thank you.
Yeah,
the DFT and the DIA. I knew the acronyms, but...
Yeah. He's the really smart guy in town who knows about films.
And puts on some great programs, by the way.
Right. But let's get to some of the automotive news. But before we do that, first I got to go, hey... Gary Vasilash, hello. And Todd Lassa from Motor Trend, hello.
John, Automobile Magazine, hello.
Oh, jeez. Hello, John. That's right.
Okay. It was 12 and a half years at one before I went to the other.
So
it happens.
Automobile Magazine.
I did it myself not long ago.
Good. I'm not the only idiot in the room.
John wasn't here last week, so he forgot. So welcome back.
Yeah, it's cool to be back. And well, you guys had a good show with Jim Campbell from Chevrolet and all the races.
We had a Corvette in here, and we just saw that clip with the Porsche and other cars there. And I'm a walking public service announcement for wearing sunscreen this week. And
Gary's got a little thing on his nose here because he had to have a little bit of surgery on it.
So,
like you say, wear sunscreen.
That's right.
And don't adjust your screens here.
Yeah, it's not going to get any better. It's not going to get any better. So
this week, what a crazy time for General Motors, huh? I mean, every time we turn around, they've issued another recall. I thought these recalls were behind them. They had already announced millions and millions and millions and millions of recalls, and this week, they piled on millions more.
And the strategy seems to be, let's do them all, let's get them out of the way when we're at our low ebb as far as public relations and public perception. Let's do them now and show, A, that we're being conscientious about this, and B, you know, by the time it clears, maybe our other, the big recall, the one having to do with the ignition switches, might be passed.
See, I see it a little bit differently. You know, GM's doing this internal investigation. We're probably only a week or two away or-ish before they release that. There are going to be more congressional hearings once that comes out. And the last thing Mary Barra wants to do is be in front of a senator or a congressman or congresswoman and go, oh, yeah, we still haven't gotten to that one yet. Mm-hmm. So they're just clearing the decks. But what's even more amazing is, or just as amazing, every other automaker in the world is drafting in behind him, announcing all kinds of recalls. Oh,
okay, but see, and this was part of the discussion last week that a point was made that maybe this is just the new normal. Maybe the new normal is that
they can't afford this.
But no, that lots of car companies, to cover their rear ends, will come out and say, you know, we're going to recall this, that, or the other thing, and, you know, just to make sure that we're okay. So I started thinking about that, and so I went to the NHTSA website, okay, and so I collected the last month worth of recalls, okay? So there's a page you can see.
Every single one,
right?
Including motorhomes and motorcycles.
So what I want to do here is I want to read, so this goes to May 21st, and this is the most recent one, which was 1,339,355 GM vehicles from 2009 to 2014, contemporary cars, including the Buick Enclave and Chevrolet Traverse models, recalled for the flexible steel cable connecting the seatbelt to the front seating positions, which may fatigue and separate. It's not a good thing if your seatbelt doesn't stay in place. But anyway, so I'm just going to read the companies that have had recalls, okay, in this last month. GM, 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 BMW. Hyundai, Nissan, GM, 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 Ford, Chrysler, Ford, GM, GM, Ford, Honda, GM, Mazda, GM, Mercedes, BMW, Dodge, Land Rover, Jaguar, Mercedes, Jaguar, Land Rover, Nissan.
And that Mazda recall was for spiders, if I'm not mistaken. Spiders in the gas tank. Was that the latest Mazda recall?
The Mazda was recalled for the gas tank, which can be overfilled. This is in the Mazda 6, 2014.
I think that's
increasing the risk of a fire. So basically, there was like
fire.
it's full of spiders. And then when you fill it up,
the fire would be way worse than the spider. But we've seen, I think, in the last 2 years and going back 5 years and going back 10 years, just this kind of increasing, this kind of snowball effect of more and more recalls and about car companies being more upfront about it. At some point, they said, look, we were better off being upfront about this and getting it out of the way than trying to fight it. But now, you know, all those GM recalls, I mean, you read them off just by company. How many of those are serious? I mean, in terms of safety related.
Well, I mean, okay, so as we said, okay, the one was seat belts. The second one was for 218,000 Avios, recall for potential fire risk.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
A recall can only happen if it's safety related. Other than that, the government doesn't have any recourse to issue a recall. So they are all safety related.
Yeah, I guess
they are.
Yeah,
right,
2014
right.
CTS.
But to your point, Todd, some are serious, real serious, and some are like whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, one of my best friends has got a Chevy HHR. He's got a big, heavy pendant hanging from the keychain. I said, so you have this car recalled? Recall, who cares?
He may.
And that's very typical. We know that one out of three people will simply ignore a recall.
Well,
on the serious ones. On the not-so-serious ones, the ignoring rate is even higher.
And then the whole question of where GM will end up in, let's say, a year versus Ford after the Explorer fiasco, and then Toyota more recently over the rather specious unintended acceleration fiasco. So, and had to pay a big.
Well, look, you know, what we keep pointing out is, A, number one, this has not affected GM sales in the showrooms whatsoever. Not one iota. GM sales are up stronger than Ford's or Honda's in the last couple of months. And what's even more amazing to me is at the used car lot, especially at, I should say, the used car auction line, the recalled cars are going up in price, not down in price. Mm-hmm. And that's due to an overall shortage of good used cars anyway. But the point is that it has not impacted GM in the showrooms or even on the used
car.
I don't think it will.
There are some lawsuits related to some lawsuits have been filed related to my car's lost value because it's a Chevy Colt.
I know, but this is being promulgated by class action lawyers
who
haven't looked at the facts and found out that, in fact, these cars at auction are going up in price, not down in price. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be very easy for GM to get these cases dismissed as long as the facts don't change, you know, and all of a sudden the auction prices do start to go down.
This may get to a subject that I know Gary wants to talk about too, and that's, you know, what kind of cocoon are we being car guys in that, you know, it's the biggest thing in our world the last couple of months now, more than that. But for the average car buyer who's looking for a mid-sized sedan with a four-cylinder engine and an automatic transmission or a pickup truck or something, maybe he or she's not paying so much attention to these recalls. And I think that has a little bit to do with how often they were being announced. I mean, part of it is that, you know, now Automobile Magazine, we've had for years, obviously, a website. There are other websites that are just strictly websites about cars. And, you know, you look at any given week, and there are a number of small and large kind of recalls here and there. You know, there's always something.
Every week?
So you think people are just going to become, you know, there'll be recall fatigue?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, I think maybe the average Camry or Chevy Malibu buyer, or Chevy Cruze buyer, I should say, that's a bigger volume car, looks at it and says, oh, this is part of buying a car, you know. They're never going to get them perfect. They're never going to be exactly right. Maybe some of the buyers realize that they're very complicated pieces of machinery. You've got many parts that go into them, and that this is just, you know, the hassle of buying a car. I might have to take it into the dealer for that.
But I think that one of the points we might be missing is the fact that, you know, while we are in this bubble and while we do look at websites that are all about cars and write magazines that are all about cars and so on and so forth, that the rest of the public is watching HBO or the rest of the public is watching Comedy Central, and the rest of the public is seeing that here are comedians who are basically saying, this is ridiculous. Look what General Motors is doing. This is absurd. I mean, there was that list of, what was it, 65 words that they came out with that you cannot use to, you know what I mean?
Which, and I tweeted, by the way, those are just extra words you and I can use, we can all use for when we run out of adjectives in our car reviews, right?
Right.
So Kevorkian-esque, I think, is my favorite.
Yeah. Hindenburg. I think that had probably something to do with the hydrogen car. But ordinary people who are living ordinary lives are going to basically say, gee, I'm not so sure about that GM car, I think.
Perhaps.
I don't think so, because you can't buy a GM-branded car. And so people are looking at what's going on at General Motors, the corporation, and going, that's disgusting. That's terrible. What a poorly run thing. These people have their head in the sand. And, man, is that new Corvette an awesome car! Or the new Silverado, or the, you know, fill-in-the-blank GM product. They don't necessarily associate General Motors, the corporation's problems with these brands whose cars and trucks they continue to go out and buy at an increasing number than what Ford or Honda have achieved in the last 2 months.
Well, so those little GM bugs that they took off the side of the car, that was a good thing.
That's a good thing they took that GM logo off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to the point of this list that Gary read off, is that's one thing. It's when Mary Barra has to go up before the House and the Senate again. And her performance was not, you know, she got a Saturday
bad.
Night
it
Live
terrible.
As a result.
And in fact, that's a good segue into another thing we got to talk about of their new vice president of public relations, Tony Cervone. And what I find so interesting about it is if you go back 6 years, Tony was being groomed for that job all along. I mean, everybody knew in GMPR that Tony Cervone was going to head up GM public relations. And then just before the bankruptcy, he, like so many other people, I don't know if he left himself or if he was blown out with so many others, but then he went to United Airlines, was the vice president of public relations there. I think, you know, once you get gasoline in your blood, you want to get back to this industry. So he ended up at Volkswagen of America. And then voila, kaboom, they announced Tony's the guy, and he's back at GM to the job that he was, I think, always meant to have.
And it happened suddenly. And it didn't happen suddenly in that there was an announcement that Steve Harris was called in as a consultant about
But we got to say who Steve Harris is.
Everybody
knows who Steve Harris is. So Steve Harris was the longtime head of General Motors PR who retired.
Oh, and let's add, who was the guy who was grooming Tony Cervone?
Well, because Tony and Steve had worked together at Chrysler. They had both been together. And then when Steve left Chrysler and went to General Motors, shortly thereafter, Tony left Chrysler and went to General Motors. And then Steve retired. Then he came back from retirement. And then he retired again. And now they brought him back out, but as a consultant. So he's not an official employee of General Motors. But you know, you talk about suddenly. So a week ago Monday, I was in San Francisco on a Volkswagen golf program and having a long discussion with Tony about what was going on with PR and in General Motors. And, you know, we had a private conversation about the whole thing. And I saw Tony in San Francisco on Tuesday. And
with Volkswagen.
With Volkswagen. And when did the announcement come out? And the thing that was completely astonishing was the fact that, I mean, he's already started.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't one of those deals where, like, you know, effective July 1st, Tony Cervone will become the vice president. He's there.
Wow, they're in full-blown emergency.
Yeah. Our deputy editor, Joe DiMascio, was there as well on that same trip, and he said that it looked like, even though he was there in person, it looked like Tony had already left the company, so to speak, that he'd moved on. He was just waiting to get back. But
anyway, when Mary Barra goes in front of Congress again, Tony Cervone better damn well make sure she doesn't put in the performance that she did the last time there. And I bet he does really give her the kind of training to come across as an in-charge kind of executive instead of somebody who doesn't really know what's going on inside her own company.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. I mean, I think that is pretty obvious. And, you know, unlike when the when Wagner and Nardelli were in front of Congress and it was just a matter of days between presentations. I mean, she's had some time. They've had time to dissect it. They've had time to realize where they went wrong. They've had time to realize what they need to do to make it right. And you know, and Tony is I think, masterful enough to be able to orchestrate a good performance for her.
Well, she went into that with all this, everything against her. I mean, you know, she had to talk, she had to not comment on anything that might be actionable. And there were a lot of questions that could have been, you know, her answer could have been recorded and then used later in court had she not, you know, demurred and said, no, I can't answer that. And then, you know, they wanted to do the hearing quickly. She obviously was hoping she could do it quickly and get it out of the way. But meanwhile, they're just basically launching the internal investigation to find out why. You know, the biggest problem with this whole thing is not the recall so much as the cover-up. We learned that back in the Nixon days, that it's all about the cover-up. And, you know, who knew it? Who knew about the problem and when and why was it held off for so long? So that's really the issue.
No, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what it's going to boil down to. And I think they had said that they wanted this internal investigation out around June 1st. So I don't think we're all that far away.
I thought I'd heard this morning that they're hoping to both have the results of the investigation in about 2 weeks and the and a settlement package of some sort. And they plan to do it on the same day. So, again, just like getting all these recalls out while they're at their low ebb in terms of public relations, if they can get both of those things out on the same day,
then it's just one news cycle.
One headline. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Well, on happier news, remember a few weeks ago when we had Ralph Gilles was sitting in this very studio and was talking about the Hellcat?
Well, yeah. Well, he was saying, "What Hellcat?"
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he didn't want to let the cat out of the bag quite.
Right.
But now we've seen the car.
We've seen the car.
And on paper, this thing looks sensational. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, 600 plus horsepower, 500 and what was it, 85, 75 foot-pounds of torque? And we know the numbers are greater than that. That's all they're admitting to right now. First supercharged V8 Hemi ever from the company. So, yeah, they're laying down some real street cred.
Yeah, I was surprised at how aggressive they are in terms of saying, you know, balls to the walls. We're gonna really put out a high performance vehicle here with performance the likes of which we've never had in a street car.
Well, and this came out during the Fiat Chrysler 5-year plan. They showed that as part of the plan and part of their plan to make Dodge a performance brand, which is not exactly what the plan looks like, because they'll still have a regular Dart. They'll have a Dart SRT with a turbo four and all-wheel drive. They'll also have these Hellcats, but they'll also have the standard Dodge Charger and Dodge Challenger.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, a nice halo for them. Presumably at some point, I missed it. Did they talk about whether that engine would eventually replace the truck V10 and the Viper?
They didn't.
It's obviously, it's got to be where they're heading. I mean, that engine's...
I seem to remember Ralph saying there was a packaging problem with the Hemi V8 and that it would not go in the Viper chassis. I seem to remember him. I think it came in one of the questions from Rapid Fire. And if I recall correctly, that's what he said, is that Hemi engine just will not package in the Viper.
Hmm. And, you know, one of the most hilarious parts of this new 6.2-liter Hemi is the fact that it comes with two key fobs, a red one and a black one.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the black one is the valet key fob, so there'll be no Ferris Bueller monkey business going on. It'll remap the engine to limit the revolutions to 400 or 4,000 RPM and horsepower to 500.
Yeah.
So, you know, taking it down to 500 horsepower.
Can't do anything with that, huh?
No, I mean, it's just, you might as well just leave it parked, right? I mean,
well, I'm thinking regarding the Viper, although, you know, that car is in a bit of trouble in terms of sales anyway, but, meanwhile, Mark Yone says that we're purposely limiting Ferrari production to 7,000 units per year. We could do way more than 10,000. Why don't they just build the engines and put them in the Viper?
Mm-hmm.
There is an idea.
I'm sure it's come up.
Speaking of cars, Hyundai has brought its first fuel cell cars into the country. This Tucson running on a fuel cell. And I give hydrogen fuel cells, I'll just throw out, for the next 10 years, like zero chance of ever really catching on. I don't even see them doing as well or as poorly, you could say, as electric cars from a sales standpoint.
But I'll tell you one thing, that you look at this deal that Hyundai is offering for people who get those cars, and
it's pretty good.
And you'd want one.
Oh, I mean,
it's just like so.
Tell me the deal. I haven't heard the details.
$500 a month. 36 months.
Yeah. It's $499 per month with $2,999 down, right?
Mm-hmm.
This includes unlimited free hydrogen refueling. So you never pay for that, and then plus
as long as they go to the two stations in the country, they're going to sell them.
Are they? So is this limited to California
state? Yeah, this is L.A. Orange County. But now,
it's easy to forget that Honda's been doing this for a number of years already.
Yeah,
and so Fortune magazine had a conference this past week, and Jim Lenz of Toyota was speaking at the conference, and the subject that he talked about a lot
is this. And he says he's bullish on it.
Yeah.
And he says PR wrote that speech for him to give.
And he says hybrids will be at the core of what they do because it's basically an electrified vehicle. But, you know, they're seeing that hydrogen will be the way forward. That'll be the game changer. But we talked about this earlier on the show or several weeks ago about how the relationship between Tesla and Toyota for the batteries for the RAV4 EV, they're no longer going to have that. And so Lenz just came out and said he doesn't see how batteries are going to be able to compete with hydrogen.
Yeah.
And he said, and he goes, you got to realize that every single one of our hybrids has a lot of batteries in it, and so we know a lot about batteries. So, you know, we know the technology. And so they're making a pretty big investment. Toyota is making a pretty big investment in helping build the hydrogen infrastructure in California.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're talking about like 60 stations.
They desperately need to do this. Here's what the backstory is, as I see it, is up to now, well, let me start by saying, if you want to sell cars in California, you have to have ZEV credits, zero emission vehicle credits. Okay, up to now, you've been able to get those credits with flex fuel vehicles, with PZEV cars, partial zero emission vehicles, with neighborhood electric vehicles, and with plug-ins.
Yep.
But CARB, the California Air Resources Board, doesn't like that scheme, really. They know that this is just sort of jiggering the thing to get you your ZEV credits. So as of next year, getting ZEV credits through the vehicles I just mentioned falls off dramatically. Even with a pure electric car, you're only going to get 2.5 ZEV credits for every pure electric, unless it has more than 300-mile range and fast refueling capabilities. And by fast refueling, what they mean is you got to be able to recharge or refuel the vehicle in about the same amount of time it takes to fill a tank of gasoline today. So, and if you do that, you get 7 ZEV credits for every one of those kinds of vehicles that you sell.
Mm-hmm. Meaning no one will get ZEV credits.
Meaning that the only vehicle that will get you ZEV credits really going forward after 2015 and by 2020, the only thing that will get you those ZEV credits in any meaningful numbers so you can sell the rest of your other cars is with fuel cell cars. And that's why everybody's coming out with these fuel cell cars. They're all going to be in Southern California. And it's really a scam, I think, because you can lose, and it was somebody at a car company pointed this out to me, and they're an upcoming guest, and I'm not going to give their name away. We'll see if they say it publicly on the show. But you can lose, as an automaker, $15,000 on every electric you sell. Sergio says they're losing $14,000 on every Fiat 500 EV. Or you can lose $50,000 on every fuel cell, but you get 7 credits. So that's the choice you get. Lose $15,000 and get 2 credits, lose $50,000 and get 7 credits.
The cost of doing business in California, which, you know, is a bigger market than Canada. But here's the other issue. And we always talk about infrastructure. You know, where do you refuel a hydrogen fuel cell car? Okay, Toyota's going to put something into that. But to me, you have another big obstacle, and that's oil. Big oil will do whatever it can to not let the infrastructure spread too far beyond. I'm not saying there's anything right or wrong about this. I'm just saying that they will do whatever is necessary to protect protect their business.
Well, here's another issue. You know, you can't drill a hole in the ground and have hydrogen come bubbling up. You have to manufacture hydrogen. That takes energy.
Yeah.
So what energy are you going to use to manufacture your hydrogen? And
probably
if,
coal.
By the way, if you do it how we do it right now and strip it out of oil or natural gas, it can be a big CO2 emitter just in the production of the hydrogen. So you got to be careful on how you go about doing it and make sure that you make clean hydrogen, as it were.
Yeah.
So I still...
But let's not forget the very smart Larry Burns, who used to be ahead of R&D in General Motors, would do the well-to-wheel study and would say that hydrogen is the most efficient fuel
possible. Larry,
so
I agree, Gary, and Larry's not the only... If you talk to the head of R&D at any car company, they'll tell you hydrogen's the answer.
Right, but I mean, in terms of efficiency, so in terms of what you need in order to get that fuel in the tank. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, we're gonna hide it over here. You know, it's like we're generating the electricity for Tesla by burning coal, but damn it, that Tesla's a clean car. You know, and so you know, you got to look at it from that point of view. But, you know, and I think Todd's right. This is all about the cost of doing business in California. That's what it comes down to. And, you know, right or wrong, that's the game you're going to have to play. And then I think, you know, as John pointed out, that the big oil is not going to lose in this because they're going to continue to put gasoline in our cars. And, oh, by the way, they have the means by which they can make hydrogen.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think we're...
In fact, yeah, we got to get on to our next segment. But another topic we're going to have to get into in a future show is... out at UMTRIE, you know, University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute, they're looking at carbon capture and sequestration so that you strip the CO2 out of the exhaust gas. And what it does from a CAFE emissions standpoint is extraordinary, just extraordinary. But this is all in the research talking phase. No one's even got a working prototype yet. But that's for a future show.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, let's take a quick break right now, and then we got to get Corey Wells and Elliot Wilhelm back here in the studio.
Introduce- Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to AutoLine's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to AutoLine.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from AutoLine's top-notch insider information with AutoLine on the go.
By the Holland Tunnel, New York City. They got about 2,900 miles ahead of them. That's a long way. That's quite a way.
I can't believe what we went through the last 24, 36 hours. Amazing.
I wish them luck. This type of thing makes the 24 hours of Le Mans look like a Boy Scout outing. There is 18,700 somewhat law enforcement agencies around the United States, and knowingly they're going to break the law at times, but they'll probably pay the dues for that.
Okay, you were just listening to another clip from the movie 32 Hours and 7 Minutes. Also joining us in the studio right now is Elliot Wilhelm, the head of the Detroit Film Theater. Do I have that right?
You do, yeah.
Now, I said head of. There's probably a fancier word. Curator,
well, I'm
CEO.
CEO, I am not, yeah. I'm working on it. But, no, I'm curator of film at the DIA, and the Detroit Film Theater is a program of films that we've been putting on there for about 40 years now, and I'm director of that program, so.
And just so everybody in the audience knows, Elliot knows movies.
Yeah, so do these guys, yeah. Too. I was talking to them a little earlier, and I heard a reference to What's Up, Tiger Lily before I came up. So.
Right. And, of course, the reason we've got Elliot in the studio with us to talk about movies and Todd Lasa and Gary Vasilash is this documentary, 32 Hours and 7 Minutes, and... Boy, let's get to Corey Wells, who has put this whole thing together. And Corey, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been calling you the director, the producer. What's the right way to describe you?
Both. On this film, I was both the director and the producer.
Okay, so give us a little bit of a background, real thumbnail sketch. What is this movie about, or this documentary?
Well, this documentary is on the old Cannonball races. Most people know Cannonball only by the 1981 slapstick Burt Reynolds, Dom DeLuise movie, but that movie was actually based on a real race, which most people don't know about. And my dad's best friend happened to drive in the very last year, in 83, and set the record for the fastest time from New York to L.A.
And that time, of course, was 32 hours and 7 minutes. And then it became controversial as, wait a minute, nobody could do it in that kind of a time. They had to have cheated. And then you went out to recreate not so much the race, but the run to see if this record could really be broken or if it had been actually achieved. Is that right?
Correct. When I started this film, at that point, I didn't even think there was footage of the participants. Thankfully, we found a trove of footage of the secret starting garage and some on road and the finishes and the starts. But the at least half the teams came to me once I found them and said that they thought that time was not real. You have to understand the second place team, who only stopped twice going across country, came in an hour and 45 minutes behind the winners. So when you start hearing facts like that, I understood why they thought there could be some cheating going on.
So, Corey, this is Gary. Were you convinced that the record had truly been set, that there was no gaming of the numbers?
Absolutely. I've known Doug Turner he's known my dad since before I was born. So he was always... around and like an uncle to me. And I knew him. He raced his entire life. And he's not the type of guy that would cheat. He But how do I, you know, say that in a film? You have a director who says, well, I knew the guy, so that means, you know, it's true. I felt like I was sort of an investigator on a trial, and I had discovery. And here I had this discovery that I didn't really want at the time. It made for a great movie. Now I look back, but I had to address it.
Corey, this is Todd Lasses. So since you've done the movie and since, should we give away what happens?
No, I don't. No.
She doesn't want the ending given away.
Okay, all right. do you think how do I put this? Are the skeptics any less skeptical now that you've done the movie?
The skeptics were the participants, and some of them, yes, but the main ones, I don't think I've shifted their view, but they were there, you know, they were driving. I think they will always have their questions, which I can understand.
These are skeptics who, no matter what you do in a film, documentary, a fact-based movie, you're not going to convince the skeptics, basically. Is that right?
Correct.
That how you
and
feel?
I think Elliot can speak to this, but I think part of a good movie is one where there's still discussion and arguments and controversy, even when you've left the theater, even when you're done seeing it, and people want to talk about it. And I think that's a great thing. So if people still think maybe there was some playing around, well, that's something to discuss.
And Corey, I think you're one of the you're on to one point about what makes the movie really interesting. But I also have to tell you that I love this picture on so many different levels because I'm not a car guy to begin with. I love driving, but pretty much what I know about cars is changing the washer fluid, you know, the usual thing. But I found as I was watching this that it became really interesting in a number of ways. I wanted to know, first of all, if you were going to find out the truth. And if this race was going to change the outcome of the record holder, and the dynamic of what was going on inside the car, all of these different things that were going on, plus a secret that is divulged about halfway through the picture, which I'm not really going to talk about either, but really, really interesting. It got better and more interesting as it went along. I loved it.
We ought to indicate to the audience who haven't seen the film what goes on in it. So basically the first part of the film is a setup whereby she's looking at the documentary footage, she's talking to the people that participated in the early races, and then she gets together with a guy named Alex Roy, who is a driver who is going to try to drive his car from Manhattan to Southern California in the most expeditious manner.
And now, you say his car. This is a highly tricked out BMW M5.
Right.
And not just tricked out from a performance standpoint, but from what? Police scanners, all kinds of radars, video cameras, and it's astonishing how well equipped this car is.
Right. And so she shows how this comes to be and how the run is made. And the most astonishing part, from my point of view, is the fact that Corey is actually in the car when this is happening. She is in the backseat of this car. And it's just incredible for me to try to imagine. And I have nothing but the utmost respect for her, to say nothing of her ability not to projectile vomit all over all that equipment.
Yeah, I mean, that the other important thing was that not only was she in the car, but she was in the car with her camera. And so we get that point of view of this journey as it takes place. And it really only becomes apparent as we're watching it that we're talking about an average speed of 90 miles an hour. And not just during the time you're driving. The entire journey from New York to Santa Monica, to maintain that speed on public roads, you ask yourself, how is it possible? Is it possible? And the movie shows us whether it is or it isn't.
Well, the movie shows us sure they were trying to get there. And Corey, one thing that I was amazed at was, where did you find this old footage of the Cannonball races and the U.S. Express? I remember the Cannonball when it all happened. I mean, Car and Driver magazine covered this extensively.
Well, Brock Yates' idea to do it, actually, so, yeah.
But the U.S. Express, I didn't know much about that whatsoever. And but go back to my question. Where did you find all this footage?
I was very lucky with the footage. The footage was taken, arranged for, by the organizer, Rick Doherty. He had run the Cannonball twice, and when the Cannonball ended in 79, a bunch of guys, he included, wanted to keep it going. They really felt like they hadn't set their own records or really had enough of the race yet. And so he arranged for the U.S. Express for the next 4 years, and he hired people to come and take this footage. Thankfully, he did this.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to get your hands on it, because I thought it was so cool looking at some of the old footage. And it's not necessarily the best footage. This is not shot by professionals, a lot of the stuff. Not the stuff you shot, but what they shot. But, boy, I'm glad you got it.
But that's what makes it work, and that's what makes it have that rough and ready kind of feel, is you're seeing that authentic look of that period. So it really works on that level, certainly.
So, Corey, what did you learn about car culture from putting together this film?
Ooh, car culture. Well, I learned that car guys are very, I don't want to say judgmental, but when a car movie comes out, they really hope for the best, and I think a lot of times are quite disappointed. I got a lot of input from guys who, you know, just like yourselves, love cars, love driving, have a respect for them. And people were worried, I think, a little bit that maybe a filmmaker who wasn't a car person would sort of take this off to a level that they would lose the interest. Or I would do something like overdub an engine noise that didn't match the car that was there. I got such great input from Alex and David and Doug and Dave and the other David Diem about really what was important to a car guy. At the end of the day, I think for everyone, it's the story. You know, have you grabbed me as an audience? Do I care about the characters? Do I care about what you want to do? So you have this balance between really telling a great story but never losing your audience. And the audience for this film, first and foremost, are car guys like yourself.
Well, I think you have an advantage there, too, actually, to a certain extent, that, you know, no matter how well done most of us think the footage, the racing footage of the movie Grand Prix was, we all just as well much like to watch actual footage of Grand Prix racing from that era. And so if you do the real stuff right, it's hard to match that with the Cannonball Run, which was a pretty awful movie, actually. Or the Gumball Rally, which is a little bit better than that. I'm also interested, too, by the way, and you, Alex Roy and Doug Turner, from what I could tell from your movie, are two very different personalities. Were you prepared for Alex Roy when you got into the backseat of his BMW for that ride?
Yeah, at that point, I had known Alex for over a year. He's a phenomenal person. He is the captain of his own ship. He really took this seriously, and he took it seriously in the way that Doug and David did back in 83. I always had a theory that you needed one Doug Turner and one David Diem in the car, and actually, you're right. Alex is not Doug Turner. Doug Turner is the same as David Maher. They are the sort of silent, funny, put-my-foot-down guy. Whereas David Diem, it was his idea to do the race, and he asked Doug to come along with him. And Alex was the same way. When I talked to Alex about doing this run across the country, we joked about it many times, like, oh, we'll just do it sometime. And we both realized we really needed to do this for the film. And he said he'd been waiting 6 months for me to ask him that question. And so I knew him very well. I knew what to expect because he has the, you know, utmost professionalism. He prepared the way I hoped he would, just like Doug and David did. I mean, he studied the tapes. He studied every piece of information I could bring him on how to do this and how to do it right. But Doug and Alex are opposite.
Elliot, let me ask you something. You know, Todd alluded to the fact that films about racing and driving are not generally well done. What is your sense of why that's the case?
Usually there is so much focusing on getting the driving right and getting the cars right, and getting the atmosphere of the track or the positioning of cars, if it's a movie in which cars are chasing each other on city streets, like in Bullet. But the characters generally take second place. And in a movie like Grand Prix that Todd was referring to earlier, those were very wooden soap opera situations around which the automobiles were dropped in. And the real appeal is the racing scenes. And you want to get through the human interest stuff so that you can get to the racing scenes. Here in this documentary, we have equal parts great racing scenes taken out of real life and a real human drama that's actually unfolding as we watch it. So it's a natural that something like this, when it's in the hands of someone who knows what she's doing in terms of editing it and telling the story in a compact way, is going to engage our emotions more than a film like Le Mans or Grand Prix or some of the other really bad racing films that have been made throughout history.
Interesting.
Good insight. Good insight. Corey, what motivated you to do this? I mean, you said that this guy was best friends with your dad and whatnot, but where did you go, whoa, here's a great movie, let's go for it?
Well, I just started getting interested in documentaries, and I was doing some short subject work, and it came back to me that, wait a minute, I think I know something that most people don't. And not only do I know this, I think it's really inspiring. You know, these guys were very serious about what they did. They took complete responsibility, and they weren't being reckless. And so I found out about this when I was about 10 years old, and it always sort of fueled my imagination from that age. And as the film started, and again, I get this, you know, this weight of, uh-oh, there's controversy, I had to see it through. I had to, you know, prove that this idea of sort of stepping out of the lines in a correct way, if that's a good way to say it, was something that I think more people should know about.
So did you worry at all when you were sitting in that car that you'd be pulled over by state police somewhere and you'd end up spending a considerable amount of time in prison?
Yes, that definitely was a worry for all of us. Alex, though, he has a way about him, and I knew that he would be the first one to sort of take over if that was to happen. So, you know, we had our stories, our storm chaser stories, and I thought we would be okay, but it was nerve-wracking for sure.
Mm-hmm. And what about anxiety over your physical safety? I mean, I can see somebody being in a film in which there are a few takes in which you have to be in a car that's running at high speed for a little while. But to be in a car that long, that's running that fast constantly, is this something that you had to really gear yourself up for? I mean, how do you get used to that? And how did you handle it in terms of sleep and any of the other things that you may have even thought of doing?
I trusted, first and foremost, I trusted the drivers. You have to trust the people driving, or you have to trust your own skill. And that's one of the, I think, reasons why not that many people ever tried this. So I knew David and Alex's skill behind the wheel. I'd driven a lot with them, and I knew what they were capable of. I knew they were safe. It was an opportunity to get the best ride ever and witness what actually took place. What is it like to be in a car going that fast for that long? And I'll tell you, it's like a different reality. You are hurtling through the U.S. You're on a different plane than everyone else is. Nothing else matters, which is the best part about it. The bills you have to pay, the appointment you have next week, whatever might have happened before is gone, because every moment you are in that moment, in that car, and it's so thrilling you don't sleep. There wasn't any sleep.
It sounds a little bit almost like you're describing the experience of an astronaut, of what certain people who have been in space have described also, is that their reality is completely altered for that time. They see the world and the universe in a different way, and it's like they're existing in a different time-space plane.
Yes, and similar to an astronaut, I had no control over the car. I couldn't get out when I wanted to. If something went wrong, it had to be dealt in the car at speed. And if I was a little late, maybe getting back to the car at a gas station, well, Alex told me they were leaving without me.
Did you have any issues with the camera along the way? Were there any points where you thought, oh, no, I might not be able to film anymore for the rest of this drive? Or were there no issues like that?
No, there were some issues. Luckily for me, I had a producer at the time named Robin Ackett, and he wired the car perfectly. He ran me through the systems, and so nothing actually internally in the car for me that I remember, except near the end when I a battery went out on Alex's lav mic, which is why at the very end we need to subtitle him, because there were no more gas stops at that point. But the major mishap we had that I'll always kind of kick myself for is that we had a chase car in St. Louis that was supposed to meet us in the morning hours. And, you know, filming speed is difficult because if you're in the car that's going fast, it's hard to see the passing rate. And so I wanted to have that shot of a car next to us and for that car to shoot and see us pull away. But David and Alex had been driving so fast that by the time we called the cameraman and the driver, he said, "You're way past us. We'll never catch you." So lost the shot completely. I tried to get the guys to slow down. I said, "Look, we have a cameraman. We have the car." And Alex just looked at me like, "Really?"
May I ask, Corey, what kind of edit ratio did you have? How much extra footage do you have that didn't make it into the movie? Can you tell us how many hours you shot?
With the historic footage, with all the interviews we did, you know, there were six cameras running in the car all the time. I think we have upwards of 800 hours of footage.
Wow.
So, Corey, I've been in a car twice that you've been behind the wheel of, and you've driven normally both times. How do you possibly drive normally after experiencing what you experienced?
Actually, I tell people that I drive much slower now than I ever have. I love to drive. You grew up in Southern California with the freeways we have, and late at night they're open. It's tempting, but I feel like I've already spent my 9 lives of vehicle sort of safety in a car by going across the country. And if I'm not going across the country, either for an emergency or to break a record, then I don't think there's any good reason to speed.
Well said.
You mentioned that you've gotten into documentaries. Is there another documentary in the working after this one?
Yes, actually, there's two other films I've begun. One is on the family, a Brazilian family that invented the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And the other one is on the 40th anniversary of the film Deliverance. You know, light topics.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. A documentary on the anniversary of Deliverance.
Yes. I have family that live in the mountains of North Georgia, and I went for a visit, and it was the summer of the 40th anniversary. And come to find, 40 years later, there is a huge rift in that town about that film and how the locals were depicted. I just sort of forgot to tell the locals that they cast in the film what the film was about.
Cool, cool. So tell us a little bit more about, for anybody else who's listening, where can they get 32 Hours and 7 Minutes?
You can get 32 Hours and 7 Minutes on our website. So 32hours7minutes.com. The 32 and the 7 are numerical. And there's options there for DVD, streaming, download. You can see the first 2.5 minutes of the film as well. And we've released over the years different clips, and there is a trailer, though the trailer is the first trailer we ever created before we needed to go across country. But all the footage is really fun, and it's 32hours7minutes.com.
Yeah, you got to see it all. You just can't.
Look, I recommend it. I haven't seen the whole thing. I was watching it just before we came into the studio here. I'm probably about an hour into it. I think it's an hour 41 minutes, something like that. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get back and see how this thing ends. I'm telling you,
it's really good. It's a wonderful picture, and it, as I say, it gets better as it goes along. I've got one question for you, quickly, Corey. You're doing a documentary on Deliverance. Are you going to be talking to any of the surviving actors, like Burt Reynolds, who happened to be in the Cannonball Run?
I know. Isn't that funny? I keep picking films where he's present. And yes, we've already interviewed some of the people that were in the film and went to a festival in Georgia, and they had this big reunion there on the river. We went down, you know, Class 5 Rapids. But yes, we do. We plan to get all the cast members.
How about the toothless guy? Is he still around?
The banjo player?
No, the fellow whose teeth... you remember that scene.
You know, I'm not sure if he is. Actually not from Georgia. The two antagonists in the film were actually Hollywood actors.
You know, I saw that movie only when it first came out, and boy, I can remember it, you know, front to back.
Yeah.
It's amazing the impact that that movie had.
Front to back might be a bad choice of words. Yeah.
Very good. That's good.
I'll just leave it at that, okay?
Why not just leave it at that?
Yep.
Hey, we're getting a number of questions in here for Corey. It's time for rapid fire. Ben, let it rip. Midwest Runner wants to know, was there a time when you or any of the team members wanted to stop, quit, or whatever?
Ooh. There is a moment, actually, in the film, and I don't want to give it away to you about what happens and why this is, but yes, there was a point at which that I thought, forget it. I'm just going to cut it here and be done with it. And Alex was not about to let that happen, and I'm very thankful for his, you know, tenacity. And even my sister called me, and she said, what do you mean you're not going to finish? You have to finish. So there
That's
was
cool.
one moment.
You need that kind of support. And I'm not just saying you. We human beings need that kind of support. Yeah. And JM1NB wants to know, what did you do in the hours after the event once the adrenaline gave out?
Well, we had a select amount of people at the Santa Monica Pier that night. All four of my parents, a journalist, Gary Jarlson, who had been the journalist at the 83 finish, was there. Some friends, we made it very small, and we all sort of got together that night. There was a hotel room at the Santa Monica Pier where we all sort of had a little after party. It took a while, I'll tell you. I think more than a few of us saw the sun come up that morning because we were still buzzing. We were still sort of hurtling across the country at that point, I think, in our heads.
And guest 885 wants to know, what was the top speed of the car? And for how long?
Well, the top speed that we hit was 160, and it was very difficult to keep that because of the traffic. Maher, David Maher, the driver, he tried multiple times to keep that car as fast as he could, but you would come up on a truck or someone, and you have to back off. You can't blow by them like that.
Yeah, and let's see here. Autoline guest 49 wants to know, in the history of the earlier races, did any women participate?
Yes, absolutely. There were women, I believe there were women in the original Cannonballs, but there was a great team in the very first U.S. Express, Becky Damone, who was married to Vic Damone. She and her stepmother, I believe they're about the same age, went across together in a Mercedes 6.9, dressed alike in these track suits. She's in the film as well. She was wonderful. She begged her dad to let her go. She came in third place as well.
Wow. Yeah. That's Holland.
Oh, but he died about a week ago. Yeah.
I think this is probably a great place to wrap up the show. And Corey Wells, what a pleasure having you on here. And like I said, after we're done here, I'm going home. I'm watching the rest of your documentary because you got me sucked into it right now. I think it's really good.
Excellent. Thank you very much for having me on. Great to see you again, Gary.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you. And Elliot, thank you very, very much. I'm so glad you liked the film.
A pleasure. Loved it. Great. And we're going to see a little bit more here before we go.
Just a minute. But Elliot, so cool to have you on.
Hey, really good.
I mean, you know, I know you say, well, I'm not a car guy, and what can I... Boy, your insight is spot on, and your comments were really good. So pleased to have you here.
It's a lot of fun to be here. Thank you.
Good. Todd, always good to have you back here.
Always good to be here. Thanks, John.
Do it again, as you well know.
And you know, amazing amount of our film, I think, that giving Elliot a run for his money.
No, I'm sure in the
Todd knows his stuff. Don't let him fool you. Yeah. He really does.
I know about a small number of pictures, basically, a certain type.
Modest. And Gary, always good seeing you.
And John?
We'll do it again next week.
Why don't we do that?
Okay. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
miles an hour.
This is so f***ing brutal. I can't stand it.
You wanna play cards or something?
Breaker 19, this is Big D and the Eagle. 90.04, we're going to get down under 90 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
A dead stop for no reason. We need anything out of the trunk?
This is killing it. This is going to kill it.
I'm convinced that we'll be fine. Convinced of it.
I'm not.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.